I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. It looks like civilians in Syria are once again the victims of a chemical attack. This time it was Saturday in Douma, a suburb of Damascus held by rebels who have been fighting the Assad regime. Dozens of men, women, and children were killed and many more needed treatment. The pictures are truly horrifying. President Trump addressed the crisis yesterday at the White House in this lightly edited clip.
I'd like to begin by condemning the heinous attack on innocent Syrians with banned chemical weapons. It was an atrocious attack. It was horrible. You don't see things like that as bad as the news is around the world. You just don't see those images. We are studying that situation extremely closely. We are meeting with our military and everybody else. And we'll be making some major decisions over the next 24 to 48 hours, trying to get people in there. As you know, it's been surrounded, so it's very hard to get people in because not only has it been hit, it's been surrounded. And if they're innocent, why aren't they allowing people to go in and prove? Because, as you know, they're claiming they didn't make the attack. So if it's Russia, if it's Syria, if it's Iran, if it's all of them together, we'll figure it out and we'll know the answers quite soon.
We asked Sam Heller, who has been following events on the ground, to join us from Beirut, Lebanon. He's senior analyst on non-state armed groups for the International Crisis Group. He's been focusing on the Syrian conflict and on jihadists. We're talking to him on Skype. Sam Heller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. I have heard suspected attack, alleged attack. Are we sure that there was a chemical attack in Douma?
It may not be possible to be totally sure, but at this point, that's what looks like what was most what most likely happened.
There are
extreme restrictions on access to the area. So to the extent that we have any understanding of the conditions on the ground, that it comes from photos and video that have come from activists who are still inside this encircled city, as well as accounts from first responders in the area.
And who used the chemicals? Do we know that?
Also something that we do not know reliably. That said, the Syrian government's use of chemical weapons is something that has been repeatedly established by nonpartisan international bodies, including the United Nations established joint investigatory mechanism. And its use in this instance would seem consistent with that record.
Is there any evidence that the rebels or the people, the forces fighting the Assad regime have ever used chemical weapons?
There have been several instances in which it's been established that ISIS or the Islamic State has used other varieties of chemical weapons elsewhere in the country. But I don't think that there's any reason at this point to suspect that. I mean, despite claims by the Syrian government and its allies to the contrary, here in this instance. And then certainly to the extent that there may have been a logic behind this, that there was kind of a military rationale to the use of chemical weapons in this instance, it seems that that was successful. That it did hasten the end of this remaining opposition enclave outside the capital.
We're talking about Douma. We're talking about, as I understand it, the Army of Islam, one of the rebel groups fighting the Assad regime. What do we know about this group?
So the Army of Islam is it was the largest armed faction in the Damascus area. It was a hard target. It was large and disciplined and effective. For years, it's held out under siege by the Syrian government and its allies. And it was the last remaining armed group in what was left of what had been a substantial opposition pocket outside the capital. negotiations had been ongoing, even as it was reduced to a single city. It had been ongoing, and then it seems the Army of Islam had been to some degree intransigent, or it had rejected the terms that were dictated to it by the government or by Russia. It seems that a breakdown in those negotiations, followed by a resumption of violence, including aerial bombing of the encircled city, as well as shelling outwards into the residential areas of government-held Damascus, may have been what prompted this a chemical attack that, again, kind of brought this to an extremely swift conclusion.
How big is the Army of Islam? Do we know?
There are a lot of estimates out there, but I personally try to stay away from them, frankly.
Does it matter?
I mean, it matters, but it's also, certainly from outside the country, I think that it's impossible to reliably know. And then I think that most of the numbers that we hear about, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 fighters, tend to be exaggerations or posturing. We can say, I think that, the Army of Islam, it was a serious military challenge, to the Syrian government in Damascus. Even if ultimately it was overwhelmed through, the sheer force of government forces combined with its, regional international allies. In this instance, Russian air power has frequently been decisive in the government's fight against opposition rebels.
Let me talk more about the civilian population in Douma. When we hear it's a suburb of Damascus, I think in this country we have a certain image of what a suburb looks like. Tell us about Douma.
Douma is it's a city in its own right outside Damascus. It was the urban center of the East Ghouta suburbs, which is a largely rural suburban area with some agriculture outside Damascus. Outside Damascus proper. Mm-hmm. Estimates of East Ghouta's residents, inclusive of Douma, which again was the main center, had been as high as, 400,000.
Wow.
Prior to its latest, its collapse under military pressure.
And where do civilians go if they're trying to leave Douma, and how do they survive if they stay?
Well, there has been, I think that civilians have gone in a number of directions as the government's forces and its allies have overrun or seized areas throughout the Ghouta. The Russians also broadcast the existence of a set of humanitarian corridors, they called them. Although initially it seemed many residents were reluctant to employ them to exit the area for fear of retaliation, imprisonment, torture on the other side if they entered into to government-held territory. The people who are left in Douma, the deal that the Army of Islam has consented to in the wake of this chemical weapons attack entails the busing of the faction's militants, as well as their families and civilians who, for whatever reason, decide that they're unable to exist under government control, up to a Turkish-guaranteed area in northern Syria. A fair number of people who cannot expect to safely exist under restored government control.
Because they'll be, targeted because of their allegiance to the rebels who've been fighting the Assad regime?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable expectation, and it's something that I think we've seen elsewhere. There's also, I mean, it's, I think that the, for many of them, it may be difficult to return to life under a system under which whatever their real feelings or their, you know, commitment over these past 7 years to the opposition, to a revolution that requires them to vocally and enthusiastically articulate their support for Assad and the Syrian government.
This is something I'll be picking up with the two guests who will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. But to you, Sam Heller, can we say at this point that the Assad government is winning the civil war, or maybe has even won the civil war?
I think we'll have to see. I mean, I think, well, partially it depends on whether we're about to see a international military intervention, a new one, by the United States and its allies inside Syria. And if so, then what the scope of that is. But also, certainly the balance of international forces that are now vying for control of Syrian territory makes it difficult to make a clear pronouncement about who has won at this point. I think we can say that, I mean, the government is currently consolidating control of its core territory, which includes the country's main economic centers and its most populous areas. That includes East Ghouta and it includes Douma. But as it closes these remaining opposition enclaves within its own territorial stronghold, and then approaches the edges of the country, it gets more complicated there, because then you have foreign guarantors who stepped in, you have occupying foreign militaries, or in the case of the Southwest, you have a set of complications and tripwires and potential of maybe Israeli intervention.
Mm. And there was an alleged attack on a Syrian base by Israel. Sam, we're almost up in a break here, but you mentioned all the players, and these are just, besides the United States, obviously Syria, Turkey, Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia. You also mentioned ISIS, and the Kurds are all fighting in Syria. Has this civil war then become a proxy war? In about 20 seconds, and then we have to take a very short break.
I think to a large extent, but at the same time, I wouldn't discount the agency of some of the Syrian players, especially the Syrian government itself and President Bashar al-Assad, who to some extent is using his great power allies, I mean, Iran and Russia, to his own ends.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Sam Heller from the International Crisis Group, joining us by Skype from Beirut, Lebanon. And we have two guests waiting in the wings as we carry on this conversation about the crisis in Syria, the possible U.S. response to what has been happening there, including the chemical attack over the weekend. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Just to recap here, the Syrian civil war that began as a protest against the Assad regime has dragged on for some 7 years and has devastated a lot of the country. There are hundreds of thousands of internally displaced refugees, and many who have fled to neighboring nations. The humanitarian crisis has been exacerbated by chemical attacks, including one that reportedly took place last Saturday in Douma, a suburb of Damascus. Here's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley speaking yesterday at a meeting of the Security Council in a lightly edited clip.
What we are dealing with today is not about a spat between the United States and Russia. This is about the inhumane use of chemical agents on innocent civilians. We have already introduced and circulated to the Council a resolution demanding unrestricted humanitarian access to the people of Douma. We also call on this Council to immediately reestablish a truly professional and impartial mechanism for chemical weapons attacks in Syria. The United States is determined to see the monster who dropped chemical weapons on the Syrian people held to account. History will record this as the moment when the Security Council either discharged its duty or demonstrated its utter and complete failure to protect the people of Syria. Either way, The United States will respond.
Sam Heller from the International Crisis Group staying with us for the next 10 minutes or so. Joining us also is Ambassador James Dobbins, Senior Fellow and Distinguished Chair in Diplomacy and Security at the RAND Corporation. He held a number of State Department and White House posts from President Johnson through President Obama. Ambassador Dobbins, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Ilan Goldenberg, Senior Fellow and Director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. I should add that he served as a Senior Professional Staff Member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee covering Middle East issues for Chairman Kerry and Chairman Menendez, and acted as one of the lead drafters of the Syrian Transition Support Act, which provided additional authorities to arm the Syrian opposition. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you should tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Ambassador Dobbins, I want to pick up on something that I put to Sam Heller, which is to say that President Assad has won the civil war. Perhaps it's time to in a sense, have him declare victory and end the fighting. Is that even possible?
I don't think it's immediately possible, but I think it's in the medium term, not only possible, but likely. And the question is whether the United States acts to accelerate, retard, or just stands passively by while it happens. I do think that that the best thing for the region and for the Syrian people is for the civil war to end and to end as quickly as possible.
What do you think President Trump should do?
I think in the short term, some punitive strike may be necessary to sustain American credibility, given all we've said. But I think in the longer term, we ought to set some reasonable conditions for the U.S. withdrawal from Syria. One of those conditions absolutely necessary is some protection for our Kurdish allies. I think they have to be granted a degree of autonomy and an ability to protect their region, and we need to help them negotiate that. I also think that we ought to condition our withdrawal on the withdrawal of foreign militias from the rest of Syria, in particular Hezbollah and the other Iranian-backed militias. And I think that once it's clear that Assad has won, he'll want them to go home as well.
Ilan Goldenberg, what would you advise the president to do?
Well, I think, and great, thanks for having me.
Sure, nice to have you back.
I think, first of all, I agree with a lot of what Ambassador Dobbins just said, but not everything. I would argue for, at this point, you have this conflict where you have a number of different zones inside the country controlled by different actors. And so maybe the most meaningful thing we can do to try to end the conflict, which I completely agree with should be the top priority at this point, is trying to essentially negotiate de-escalation zones and stop the fighting at the places where, you know, you have these different actors. You have a Turkish zone, you have a Kurdish zone in the northeast, you have really an al-Qaeda-held zone in the northwest, you have most of the country held by Assad and also a zone held by some rebels supported by Jordan, Israel, and the United States in the southwest. And negotiating, I think, at the beginning, at least, an end to the fighting at these points where these different areas meet, and then over time trying to get from that to some kind of an arrangement for a long-term end to the conflict that central government but relatively decentralized power is probably the best arrangement. But that might require American forces to stay for a very long time. I agree eventually they have to withdraw, but we might be there for years.
Well, Sam, let me go back to you. How many U.S. forces are now in Syria?
I think there's roughly about 2,000 special forces that are on the ground. So it's not a large commitment. But even that, now there are it looks like President Trump is interested in withdrawing even what forces we have, which would then lift a U.S. protection from this Kurdish-controlled area in Syria's northeast. I think that when we're looking at these zones of control, these foreign-guaranteed areas on the edge of the country, I think that their sustainability is linked in large part to the credible, lasting commitment of whatever foreign guarantor has assumed responsibility. Certainly, I think Turkey has stepped in the northwest, and then that may be a lasting commitment. But suddenly, America's involvement in the northeast, if President Trump gets what seems like his way, maybe in question.
Well, you mentioned the fact that, and the president did say last week that he wanted to get out of Syria, and we also heard him say yesterday that the U.S. is going to respond to this chemical attack. It is confusing, James Dobbins, what our policy, what our mission is in Syria.
Well, I think that's true. I think that the last comprehensive statement was by Secretary Tillerson back at the beginning of the year. The text of his statement has disappeared from the State Department website, mm-hmm. along with everything else he ever said. But it was a mixture of getting rid of Assad, getting rid of Iranian influence, and suppressing the Islamic State, a combination which was incompatible and not achievable within the limits of the commitment we had made to Syria, and now the president wants to make an even smaller commitment, and yet at the same time now seems to be threatening an even larger intervention as a result of this chemical weapons attack. So to say that our policy is confused and uncertain is an understatement.
Well, and I do want to pick up on that, but Sam, I know you have to leave us, but what is the U.S. mission? My understanding is that we're there in many ways to protect the Kurds and also to fight ISIS. Is that what the U.S. is doing in Syria?
It had been what we were doing until, as Ambassador Dobbins pointed out, the United States articulated a new strategy in January of this year. But now, President Trump's stated desire to exit the country and to withdraw from the country is in direct contradiction to that. Hmm. So it's not clear where American strategy and objectives still stand. If we do undertake a precipitous withdrawal, it does seem likely to have disastrous, destabilizing consequences. In northeast Syria, in areas that we have with local Kurdish-led partners liberated from ISIS. Because a deal for the reintegration of this area or the local autonomy of this area is not there yet. And then without that in place, we may be looking at a new escalation involving either an attack by the Syrian government or neighboring Turkey, or both.
Mm. Well, Sam Heller, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times, and he's with the International Crisis Group, and he did join us by Skype. Sam Heller, thanks so much.
Super. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Ilan, let me turn to you. And we know it was about a year ago, President Trump ordered the bombing of an airfield last spring. This was in response to a chemical attack. It was a limited strike. And here we are once again facing a chemical attack that has hurt so much of the civilian population. What good does an attack do?
Well, I think basically, a strike does deter potential future use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime, although not necessarily, obviously last year's attack, the deterrent effect has worn off since they chose to use these chemical weapons again.
Right.
But I think, and I'm deeply skeptical, really, that we'll do anything other than a symbolic attack that tries to deter Assad, and also maybe establish for the rest of the international community that this is a norm that we object to and that comes with consequences. But fundamentally, as long as the president's not willing to get further engaged, either in negotiating the diplomatic end to the settlement or in keeping our forces there, we're not going to see anything beyond that. And I think this is the problem with what we saw about the attack a year ago. The response was appropriate, it was symbolic, but there was all this talk afterwards about how this would give the United States all this leverage, new credibility in Syria to then negotiate something more significant. It didn't do any of those things, partially because there was no diplomatic plan for what comes afterwards, and partially because I don't think the president, and he's not alone, neither did President Obama, really want to get deeply engaged in this. And so that's, as long as where we're at, all we're going to see, I think, is a small symbolic strike, but nothing more significant than that, which I think makes some of the comments, for example, that you played from Nikki Haley earlier problematic because we're talking a really big game, mm-hmm. but all we're really going to do is something small and symbolic.
Do you see that, Ambassador Dahmus? If you talk tough, you better respond tough as well.
I agree with Ilya on what the most likely outcome of this is. I do agree that that there's been a good deal of hyperbole in terms of threatening our reaction. I wouldn't argue that because we've employed hyperbole and threatening action, we now have to escalate our reaction. Assad has been bombing his own people for 7 years, mostly with high explosive,
right.
Occasionally with chemical weapons. I frankly don't see all that much of a difference. I understand there's a legal difference. Chemical weapons are illegal, and one ought to respond to that. But my own view was back in 2011, 2012, that the red line we should have drawn was stop bombing your own people or we will intervene. I think if we'd intervened at that stage, we could have had a decisive effect. I think it's too late now.
And conventional bombing certainly has done more destruction of infrastructure, of buildings, and affected, Ambassador Dahmus, the civilian people in a much more critical way.
Oh, infinitely more.
Well, let me ask about chemical weapons. I want to put this to both of you, but Ilan, I'll start with you. There was this red line that President Obama drew in the sand, basically saying if you cross this red line and use chemical weapons, we will respond. There will be, quote unquote, enormous consequences. Syria agreed to get rid of its chemical weapons, but here we are a couple of years later, and apparently the Assad regime is using chemical weapons. So what does it say about what Obama was able to or tried to negotiate? Ilan?
Yes, I'm there.
Yeah, go
can
ahead.
You hear me?
Yes, I can.
I think that this deal that was negotiated on removing the chemical weapons was done in a very rapid, sort of week-long process. Just an idea that suddenly came in and that the Russians were able to push forward that de-escalated what would have been a military situation. I still think there was a lot of benefit in getting all of those chemical weapons out. So now what it does show is it wasn't perfect, obviously. The Syrians hid some of their stockpiles and are using them now. But, you know, it's better to have less chemical weapons running around Syria than otherwise. But I also very much agree with what Jim was saying, that fundamentally we made this too much about chemical weapons and not enough about the other crimes going on inside Syria. And that if we had intervened a lot earlier, and if President Obama had chosen to intervene a lot earlier, we could have had a very different outcome. But at this point, you know, the options are really limited and quite bad.
Obviously, there's the advantage of hindsight, Ilan, but intervened how? And intervened the way we did in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in other countries?
Sure.
Libya? I was thinking of Libya. I mean, there are many options there.
Yeah, no, there are. And what I would have argued for and what I was arguing for at the time was a much more aggressive approach to arming the opposition, combined with creating areas where we essentially deterred the Assad regime from entering through a combination, you know, which wouldn't necessarily, things like safe zones, not necessarily a no-fly zone over the country, but it turns out you can create some of these things. We have actually created one in northeastern Syria. And so the problem was we were always 6 months or a year behind. Eventually we armed the opposition, but we didn't do enough of it, and we did it when it was too late. In some ways, we ended up with the worst of all worlds. If we really wanted the conflict to end quickly, we could have intervened relatively decisively and aggressively from the start, or we could have sat on the sidelines and just let Assad win. But we intervened just enough and armed the opposition just enough to drag it out for years without doing enough to actually be decisive. So I think we ended up with the worst of all worlds.
Ambassador Dahmus, again, with this advantage of hindsight, is there any way to know what the United States should have done?
Well, I know what I recommended at the time, which was that we intervene to destroy the Syrian Air Force, which I think we could have done within 24 hours with few, if any, casualties. The planes were sitting on the ground, cruise missiles, stealth fighters could have gone in and destroyed them, probably at no cost to the United States. At that point in the war, Assad was losing ground. He was being defeated on the ground, and in the air was the only place where he retained sovereignty. So this would have been a pretty striking blow, and it could have reversed the dynamic, and an opposition, which at that point was much more moderate than it is today, might have prevailed. Now, you can answer that, yes, that's what we did in Libya. We could have done it in Syria. Russia wasn't there, Iran wasn't there, and we could have seized control of the air over Syria at no particular cost to us. But then we would have had a situation like Libya in which, yes, the opposition won, and then the country still fell apart. And I would concede that was a possible outcome of what I was what I was arguing for. But I think we would have probably succeeded in overturning Assad and replacing him with some other regime, although I would admit that whatever replaced Assad may not have been a great improvement.
Almost having a break here, but Ambassador Dobbins, what I hear you say is there were and perhaps are no good options.
I don't think there are today, because what's left of the opposition is even more radical and unsavory than Assad himself. It's dominated by the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. So there really aren't any, I don't think there are any better options than quickly ending the war, accepting that Assad has prevailed, and setting conditions for our withdrawal, which facilitate the stabilization of the country and the return of many refugees.
That's Ambassador James Dobbins, currently Senior Fellow and Distinguished Chair in Diplomacy and Security at the RAND Corporation. And he held a number of State Department and White House posts from President Johnson through President Obama. Also with us is Ilan Goldenberg, Senior Fellow and Director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. We are talking about the crisis in Syria. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're discussing the current escalation of the conflict in Syria, what's at stake for that country, for the international powers involved, the way forward. And I should add that President Trump said yesterday afternoon that the U.S. will respond. We do not know what the U.S. will do, at least so far. 1-888-477-9499 is the number to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me get Rick from Hokes in Delaware to join us. Rick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. Thank you so much for your show and the distinguished guests.
Thanks.
I just want to make the point about Assad. You know, for him, it's Syria, Inc. They are the wealthiest family by far in Syria, counting his cousins and brothers-in-law and all. They own the cell phone company. They're billionaires, not millionaires. So if he were to leave power, he leaves a tremendous base out. So being in Russia and Siberia in exile is not a great option. So he does not want to leave, has no intention of leaving. He'll die there because there's too much at stake. He's a different type of political, economic animal, and he's always been that way, and he'll be there another 7 years if we let him.
Well, Rick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Ilan Goldenberg, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reality is there was a time where Assad might have accepted some kind of a phase transition and departure when he didn't look like he was winning the civil war, and he actually wasn't winning the civil war. But with especially the Iranian intervention and the Russian intervention in the last few years, the number of ground forces, the Iranian militias, the Iranians have there, which people estimate between 50,000 and 100,000, and Russian air power, there's no reason for him to leave. He's winning. And at this point, the cost that it would take to put us in a position where we could force him to leave is not something that the United States is willing and the international community are willing to do, and not something that I think is likely any time in the future.
Ambassador Dobbins, what does Russia want out of this conflict?
Well, I think first of all, it wants respect and acknowledgement as a major power. This is a way of reclaiming its major power status. Russia has had a long-term relationship with Syria going back to the Soviet Union, and it's preserving its position really in the only country in the Middle East in which it has a strong traditional position. I think it's pretty much confined to those two areas. I think it was a opportunistic move. Putin correctly assessed that the United States was not going to react strongly to a Russian intervention, that a Russian intervention would be relatively low cost and would probably be quite effective.
Do you think, Ambassador Dobbins, that it was significant that the president, when he tweeted about this, named Putin along with Russia and some other countries?
Well, I do think that's significant just because the president has been personally so reluctant to name and shame Putin, with whom he's tried to have a good relationship. So I think from the level of the president's rhetoric, it does represent a shift. I don't know that it's going to represent a significant shift in terms of our policy towards Syria. I think it's going to be very hard for the president to find some way that significantly diminishes Russian leverage in that situation.
Ilan, and you can respond to that as well, but let me also ask about this Israeli, apparently this Israeli mm-hmm. strike on a military base in Homs that happened yesterday. First of all, I guess the timing of that, and what message Israel is sending?
Well, I think the Israelis might have taken advantage of the chemical weapons strike to then launch these attacks, but we should not confuse Israel's intentions inside Syria having much to do with chemical weapons. I think they're much more focused right now on the long-term position of Iran inside Syria, something that they've been really concerned about with for the last couple of years, and the possibility of Iranian forces on their border, on their northern border, through the Iran's elite paramilitary force, the Quds Force, which is supporting and arming a lot of different groups here. And so this is a real danger. We had a couple months ago an Israeli plane that was shot down after one of these strikes, and this is something the Israelis do on a somewhat regular basis and have for years gone after Hezbollah, which is one of Iran's partners and allies. But if that plane that was shot down a couple months ago had come down in Lebanese or Syrian airspace instead of Israeli airspace, we would have had a potential major conflict on our hands because the Israelis don't leave soldiers behind. So this is an area where the U.S. really needs to get more engaged, and also the Russians need to get more engaged, and the Russians need to be doing what they can to restrain the Iranians, and we need to be doing what we can to reassure and restrain the Israelis and keep them apart from each other so we don't have another major conflict starting in addition to the civil war on this part of Syria and Lebanon.
Ilan, can we say this is a civil war that's also a proxy war?
Absolutely. I would argue that what you had really is a civil war started, and all these different actors were concerned about losing potential influence in the country. And so you had the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the UAE, and you had Iran and you had the Russians and the U.S. and everybody's throwing money and weapons at basically supporting their own different partners, partially because they're afraid of losing influence and partly because they see an opportunity to increase influence. But the bottom line is, if you look at the history of civil wars, and one of the factors that really causes them to drag out much longer is when you have external actors intervening, because their capacities are a lot higher. And with just a small investment, they can cause what's happening in Syria, a place like Syria, to go on and on and on. And that's exactly what's happened here. It's a poster child for how terrible civil wars can become when external actors begin to intervene.
And Ambassador Dobbins, just to pick up on that, I mean, just, we hear stories, we hear interviews, we see pictures of the civilian population. We know that so many have been displaced within the country. Many have fled to other countries. You see cities that it's just hard to imagine human beings can live there. What do we do about this humanitarian crisis?
Well, of course, we and others are providing assistance to displaced populations and to refugees. That's, of course, a Band-Aid. The only real solution is to end the civil war and to allow Syrians to go home. Now, some of them won't want to go home, either because they're more comfortable where they've ended up or because they fear the regime. But a significant number of the refugees that are now in Europe, and particularly in Turkey, would go home if the security situation allowed.
Right.
And so ending the civil war is the key to not liberating the Syrian people, but at least providing a degree of security where most of them can live safely and go about their normal lives.
But in the meantime, and you mentioned Syrian refugees in Europe, the U.S. has a Muslim ban. It's, you know, it's been it is being litigated in court. But nonetheless, the United States has not really opened its doors to Syrian refugees. The president talks about the horror of what he sees. And these are, of course, civilians who are being affected by these chemical attacks and the attacks in the more conventional warfare. Ambassador Dahmann, should we open the door, at least temporarily, to provide some kind of haven for these people?
Well, even Obama took a relatively small number of Syrian refugees. I can't remember the number. It may have been tens of thousands, but I don't remember the exact number. Ilian may remember. Nothing compared to what Germany took. It took a million of them in 1 year, a million of refugees. It included refugees from other countries, but mostly Syrian in 1 year. Trump has reduced that number even further. We are still taking some refugees, but a much reduced number. So the answer is no, the U.S. isn't doing enough in that regard. But again, simply harboring refugees doesn't solve the problem. And the more you do it, the more refugees you get. Ending the civil war really is, I think, the priority solution.
Ilian, how do you see that?
Well, I agree with Jim. You have to end it where it is. Primarily, yes, we should be taking more refugees, absolutely. But really, I think the problem is that, you know, what happens in Syria doesn't stay in Syria. And you've seen this with both two things that have come out of there. One is the massive flow of refugees. Two is terrorist attacks and various extremist groups that we've seen, whether primarily in Europe, but also some self-inspired in the United States. These things together, even if you say, well, Syria is far away and it's a civil war and it's their problem, those two things together have been a key factor behind the rise of populist politics in Europe and the United States that at this point are threatening the continuation of the European Union, threatening NATO, threatening some of the basic core institutions that have really led to an American-led order since 1945 and brought stability to large portions of the world. And so, you know, you can say this is just about the Syrian civil war, but it is a lot about things that are much more profound than that, and things that start to get at, you know, fundamental core national interests of the United States.
We have an email from Imad who wrote us a bit ago. Today in Douma, Syria, the government are fully winning the war and the terrorist groups are fully defeated. No doubt the terrorists, they have one option to get the U.S. and others to turn against the government, ending up killing more civilians. And it looks like obviously a very, very depressing picture of the future there. Ambassador Dahmann, let me ask you about Thomas Bolton. He's the new National Security Advisor. First week on the job, first day on the job yesterday, when the president talked about some kind of military action. He's got a track record of things that he said. He sounds like he's not afraid to use the military. What kind of a test is this for him?
Well, he has been a hawk. He has advocated military action in a variety of circumstances. He's never actually been in a position to carry through that threat.
Right.
And the fact that he wasn't in a position to carry through the threat may have allowed him to advocate it a little more liberally. Now that he is in a responsible position in which, if his advice is taken, it could lead to fairly substantial, serious consequences, John may think twice before advocating. Some of the kinds of things that he's previously on the record as supporting, including, for instance, preventive attack on North Korea or a conflict with Iran. In this case, it's an interesting test. The administration's verbal response to the chemical weapons attack of a couple of days ago has been very strong, and it's going to be very difficult to match that in actual military response. And frankly, I don't expect, and I hope, that they won't.
I said Thomas Bolton. Obviously, you correct me, Ambassador Domins. It's John Bolton. Do you know him?
Yes.
How would you describe him?
Well, we've always had perfectly civil relations. He's on the hawkish end of the spectrum. I'm more toward the middle. But we were never in direct conflict in our times in several administrations together.
Ilan Goldenberg, how do you see John Bolton?
Well, I think the one thing to keep in mind about this particular case is that, you know, Bolton's history is not necessarily, he hasn't necessarily advocated for humanitarian interventions, and the types of intervention that you'd be looking at here. Most of his, he's not a neoconservative or in that meld at all of pushing for, you know, democratizing countries. So it's not clear to me that this is a case that really tests his view on the world the way I think that the cases that Ambassador Domins talked about, Iran and North Korea. I do think, I hope actually, that he plays a constructive role in trying to convince the president to maintain a long-term force presence in Syria and Iraq. Because I think if there's one thing we've learned in the last 15 years of fighting, we're not good at dealing with these sort of terrorist safe havens and unstable states. But we've learned that putting 150,000 troops into a country and doing full-blown counterinsurgency just isn't worth the cost and isn't politically sustainable in the United States. We've also learned that zero is the wrong number, since it leaves us vulnerable and in many cases unable to, you know, just sort of keep our eyes on the ground and help our local partners. But a small level of forces can make a meaningful difference, as it has in the counter-ISIS fight, in at least keeping the worst things from happening and enabling our partners to be much more effective. And I hope he's able to make that case to the president, because it seems like, despite everybody making that case to the president seems pretty determined to leave Syria, which is something that worries me greatly.
Let me squeeze one more question, and this is to you, Ambassador Domins. There was a meeting last week in Turkey between the president of Iran, Turkey, and Russia having to do with the Syria crisis, but not the United States. Is that significant?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the Syrian crisis has certainly driven a wedge between the United States and Turkey, maybe unavoidably, and it's led to this rather odd relationship among competitors, and Turkey, Iran, and Russia are competitors. They're not allies, but they have some overlap of interest in Syria, and one of their overlaps is reducing the American role and reducing the Kurdish role.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times to bring a little bit of clarity to this complicated situation. James Domins, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Senior Fellow, Distinguished Chair in Diplomacy and Security at the RAND Corporation, and again held State Department and White House posts from President Johnson through President Obama. Ilan Goldenberg, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
And he's Senior Fellow Director of the Middle East Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. And we began our conversation with Sam Heller from the International Crisis Group, and he joined us from Beirut, Lebanon. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about this program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.